it's a rebuttal for appellant's counsel. And so, counsel for appellant, see you seated. If, whenever you're ready, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Michael Boulette here on behalf of appellant Daniel Tenenbaum. Your Honors, at the end of the party's marriage, Ms. Deshpande received $6.3 million in liquid assets. On top of that, she received $5,000 a month in maintenance. Taken together, that amounts to 99.8% of the party's non-business assets. For his part, Mr. Tenenbaum received his business, of which $5 million was intangible goodwill, a hope, a dream, not cash, not money in the bank, something that may have value in the future. We appeal that decision on three principal grounds. The first, the determination of Ms. Deshpande's need for maintenance, a manufactured need that assumes she would make the worst possible financial decisions in order to create need that she did not have. The second, the valuation of Mr. Tenenbaum's ongoing obligation to buy into his company as an option that could be valued using a model called the Black-Scholes model. And the third, the failure to exclude any personal goodwill value from $5 million of imputed goodwill in a seven-person, two-partner, five-employee investment advisory firm. I'd like to begin, if I could, with maintenance, because maintenance involves some very familiar principles to this court on review, the most fundamental being that the recipient of maintenance needs to show a need for it. And we determine that need in reference to ability to meet need. And we see this arise in both the employment setting, what ability does a maintenance recipient have to go out and earn income from Passolt, this court's decision in Passolt, also the ability to muster assets for your own self-support and investment. So we see the more recent case in Curtis at the Minnesota Supreme Court, as well as the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision in Lyons. And what all of these cases fundamentally tell us is that we assume, before seeking maintenance from a former spouse, you will muster your own resources to attempt to self-support. For Ms. Deshpande, those resources included $6.3 million in assets, which at a of the most conservative, were earning 7% rates of return, with investment and equity portfolios earning as much as 25% rate of returns in growth equities. The district court here assumed a 4% rate of return, lower than Ms. Deshpande's most conservatively invested assets. Now, investment portfolios of $6.3 million aren't something most of us have familiarity with, but this has a parallel to a much easier maintenance obligation. If instead of $450,000 in maintenance income, Ms. Deshpande had $450,000 in employment income, she's a doctor, she's an investment banker, and she had told the district court, I get it, but I'd really like to go be a teacher and cut my income, we would not affirm the district court's finding of need based on a voluntary decision to reduce past historical income.
Mr. Boulette, can I clarify something? As I hear you saying today, and I think I saw that in your briefing too, you're not arguing that spousal maintenance is not appropriate, I don't believe, but you're basically arguing the dollar amount that the court ordered. And then because from there you go, you're raising the questions of the way the interest income is calculated and so forth, and then the sale of the house and using, or purchase of a house using high-yield investment security. I guess my question is kind of a high-level one. Aren't those factual determinations that the court made that, unless we find clear error, would not be a basis for reverse? And they sound like the kind of arguments you did make, I assume, and would have made, but lost. And so how, though, does that affect our review under the clear error standard or abuse of discretion?
All of those are great questions, Judge Sleater. Let me take them in turn.
Thank you.
So the first question is it really about the amount of maintenance or whether there should be maintenance at all? Page 31 of appellant's principal brief is most helpful in this regard, because what you can see is if the district court had adopted any other assumptions in terms of how much Ms. Deshpande invested or the rates at which she invested, Under any of those circumstances, there's not a need for maintenance.
You're referring to the chart you included? That's the chart?
Correct, page 31 in the brief. So it is a dispute as to the need for maintenance, but you're right to say that the need for maintenance is driven by a factual determination of Ms. Deshpande's ability to self-support. Fair enough. That is absolutely reviewed for an abuse of discretion. The reason you have an abuse of discretion here is because the district court is imagining into the record a more conservative rate than what a party actually earns. So this is not a situation in which a party had a 10-year historical rate of return and the circumstances of the investor changed, a la Curtis, and warranted a new rate. And so we have findings by the district court as to why history isn't informative of the future. We simply have the district court saying, well, I see that there was this 9% rate. I'm going to let Ms. Deshpande liquidate her highest earning asset to buy a house, even though she has $2.2 million in cash she could use for the same purpose. That leaves me with a slightly over 5% rate of return. The district court finds that rate of return, a rate of return which by itself obviates the need for maintenance on a $6.3 million portfolio. And then it goes another percent and a half lower to select a rate of return Ms. Deshpande has never actually earned, lower than anything she ever has. You're right, Your Honor, that is judged for an abuse of discretion. With all due respect to the district court, selecting a rate lower than a party's actual earnings is an abuse of discretion, because instead of looking to their ability under 518.552, we are making assumptions that assume that instead of maximizing that ability, like Passolt or like Curtis, doing what a recipient reasonably can to meet their own needs.
Wasn't there expert testimony, though? And you got a lot of moving parts because, well, you have a lot of money. And so when you had a lot of money, you had a lot of moving parts. And so the highest yield investment also had a huge capital gains liability that the expert, I assume for a respondent, testified that in India, under law in India, if used to purchase a house, would avoid the capital gains. So that would have to be built in, and plus it happens to be a high yield but low earning income for her. So aren't all those the parts the judge took into account? We couldn't just pull one part and say, well, it's the highest yield. And
not really, Judge Sleeter, for a few reasons. So one, capital gains are only going to be realized on this whole portfolio if you liquidate the whole portfolio to buy a house. Ms. Deshpande didn't need to do that. Now, we dispute that the court should have made a $1.2 million allowance to purchase a home when the parties had decades-long history of renting and when the amount she was earning on her assets was far greater than what she could save in rent, and that wasn't reasonably disputed.
But there's a basis in the record for purchasing. I mean, they had purchased homes. They had the place in New York. Your client was purchasing something in Minneapolis for his, living purposes. So, I mean, that is supported by the record.
I don't know that it's supported by the record, Your Honor, in the same way that the Rask home purchase isn't supported by the record, right? Yes, the parties owned real estate in other places. They never owned real estate in India. And the reason they didn't was made clear in the record, which is what you save in rent is far lower than what the parties, Ms. Deshpande in particular, had historically earned. Coming back to your question, Judge Sleeter, on the cap gains, you don't have cap gains if you don't liquidate the portfolio. You don't liquidate the portfolio if you use the existing $2.2 million in cash you're getting to buy a home. There was no reason for the district court to assume that Ms. Deshpande takes her highest earning asset and liquidates it instead of using the cash she had in the bank from Mr. Tenenbaum to buy the very same home.
But wasn't that the point, though, of the experts, and maybe it was some battle to that, is that why an expert might recommend that, because at some point you will have that capital gain, hence that's a reasonable calculation to use that versus other money.
Well, A, I don't know that we know that, and I don't think the record tells us that. B, we already accounted for Ms. Deshpande's capital gains in how her income would be taxed. Both experts assumed all Ms. Deshpande's income would be taxed, including the income she would have received from investment return. More importantly, why would a spousal maintenance obligor bear the burden of helping a former spouse minimize a someday tax liability that they could avoid? Certainly that's some tax planning Ms. Deshpande could do, it seems unreasonable to hold her former spouse to account for that. I realize I'm going quickly, and we only have a few minutes left. I want to shift to the options issue quickly.
Before you do that, can I just clarify, although it is a second issue or third issue, perhaps, question, wouldn't it be true that, number one, that spousal maintenance would be affected if we agree with your arguments on either the issues, I think as you identified, two and three with regard to valuation, because obviously that is part of the assets that were then awarded to the respondent.
Yes, Judge Souter. These are issues that pull and tug, and so if they go back, they likely go back together. With respect to the options issue, the record is clear we don't have an option, and that is the central assertion in our brief. Now, I want to bring the court to the standard of review because appellant acknowledges that valuation questions generally are judged for an abuse of discretion. And when we are determining the legal effect of contractual documents, that gets reviewed de novo. This court can read the shareholder agreement and the buy-sell just as well as the district court. And as the Supreme Court pointed out in Gill versus Gill, that gets reviewed de novo. What we have here is less a dispute about whether one particular methodology, Black-Scholes, can be applied to employee stock options or different sorts of options. What we have here is a fundamental fact that the district court made a legal error in calling an obligation to continue to buy into a practice an option. It's not an option. Why? For two reasons. One, the basic definition of an option is that it is the option, but not the obligation to make a purchase. Mr. Tenenbaum has an obligation. At a date certain, in each year, he must buy more shares of this company, whether it does well or whether it does poorly. Also critical to what makes an option at its very core is that I, as the option holder, get to decide when I exercise it. Mr. Tenenbaum couldn't do that. It was a record bad year right before the valuation date, 2019. And Mr. Tenenbaum can't forego exercising his option because it's been a bad year. Counsel goes to pains to point out 2021 was a very good year because of the resurgence of the global markets. Mr. Tenenbaum couldn't accelerate his option to capture more of those dividends or gains. The district court, in treating this thing, this obligation, this buy-in, as an option, commits legal error that is evident from the face of the documents themselves. And this was an argument, contrary to respondents' brief, that was raised repeatedly at trial and in proposed findings post-trial. So it's absolutely preserved for review. Finally, with 2 minutes left, business valuation. Now, what appellant's business valuation arguments circle around at a fundamental level is this question of goodwill. When you have a two-partner, seven-person advisory firm, consulting firm, we need to account for the non-transferable value of that firm, the value that I just can't give away because it adheres in the principles. Now, for most of us, an investment advisory firm feels out of touch, but a law firm feels very much within reach. I may have a law firm, a personal injury firm, generates very nice returns, very good income for the partners, but that income isn't realizable unless the partners stay with the firm, unless they bring their independent expertise to that process. Here, what Mr. Tenenbaum has been assigned, it's not $5 million of equipment or real estate or something tangible. He's been assigned $5 million in intangible value. It's air. It's the hope of future profits. Those future profits do not materialize without the firm's two principals. It may well be that a law firm can generate really big contingent wins, but those contingent wins evaporate when the partners disappear. So too here, the record was very clear. Mr. Tenenbaum is one of two partners. He is the lead investor, the lead manager, and the lead business developer in this seven-person operation. The district court, instead of analyzing his value to the firm, instead of asking, what is this enterprise worth if Mr. Tenenbaum walks away, and doesn't just walk away but can compete, instead it conducted a different analysis, and it chose to ask a different question. It asked the question whether he was solely responsible for business profits, and it asked the question whether all of the goodwill was personal to him. Now, It may be a fair factual conclusion that he is not solely responsible for all profits and that all goodwill is not attributable to Mr. Tenenbaum. What is not a fair conclusion, what is not supported by the record, what wasn't even claimed by respondents' experts, is that none of the goodwill value is attributable to Mr. Tenenbaum. My time has expired. I look forward to answering more questions on reply.
Very well, thank you. Counsel for respondent, when you're ready, you may approach, identify yourself, and then you may begin.
Thank you, and good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Robert Dew of the DeWitt Law Firm, and I'm appearing today for the respondent, Tara Deshpande. You got the pronunciation correct, Your Honor.
Thank you. Lucky sometimes.
I don't know how Mr. Bullett can evade the applicable standards of review in this case. The valuation of a business interest and the determination of the appropriate amount of maintenance are highly discretionary decisions, and the appellate courts give the trial courts great latitude in making those decisions. In this case, you had 7 days of testimony, 9 experts, 295 exhibits. The trial court made 81 detailed findings of fact, all based on the testimony and the exhibits. And there was no finding that was clearly erroneous. There was no decision that was an abuse of discretion. I'm going to start with the stock option argument. Appellant's arguments about his right to buy additional stock in the company at the low, low, non-adjustable price of $2.33 per share have ranged all over the board. In the principal brief, he argued that you can't apply the Black-Scholes valuation model to private stock options. It has to be public. He stated on page 56 of his principal brief that the company's, quote, absence from a publicly traded market dooms a Black-Scholes analysis. Well, in preparing our principal brief, we found authority approving the application of that model in divorce cases and by a federal district court to the valuation of options to buy stock in a private company. So now he is narrowing his argument. He said, well, what we have here are not options at all, but rather obligations to buy. Well, I checked the record. Appellant referred to his right to buy additional stock as an option 4 times in his testimony. Dr. Thorne referred to appellant's right to buy additional stock as an option 3 times in his testimony, and appellant's own appraiser referred to appellant's right to buy additional stock as an option 2 times in his testimony. Here we have to apply common sense. When a shareholder has the right to buy additional shares at a small fraction of the fair market value of the stock and a small fraction of even the book value of the shares, that right has a value far above the strike price. Whether you call it an option or an obligation, it has value. If I have both the right and the obligation to buy Apple stock at $10 a share when it's trading at around $180 a share, that right or obligation has value. I'll take that as an obligation any day of the week. In this case, the strike price was $2.33, and even the book value of the shares as of the first date of exercise after the valuation date was $14.20 per share. It was appellant's right to buy stock at a heavily discounted price that was valued by Duff and Phelps, and Joe Estabrook, who's a renowned valuation expert, testified that the application of the Black-Scholes model in this case was appropriate. There was no testimony or evidence to the contrary. On the issue of spousal maintenance, I believe Mr. Bullett started his argument by saying she was awarded, or my client was awarded $6.3 million in assets. Well, the findings of the trial court would be that even after receiving the equalizer payment, she would have $4.3 million in investable assets, not $6.3 million, and that's after the purchase of the home. The main thrust of appellant's attack on the trial court's maintenance decision relates to the trial court's approval of respondent's plan to buy a home for herself.
Before you get to that, Mr. Duke, can I ask you a point that Mr. Bullett made in his brief and today, and I'll be honest, I didn't find the answer to this, is the 4%. How is that supported in the record for her annual interest income that she'll receive?
Well, what's interesting, Your Honor, is that the trial court actually made a finding that when you consider the rampant inflation and the currency devaluation in India and the declining interest rates, she was actually receiving, after inflation, a rate of return less than 1%. So that's when inflation is taken into account. The trial court never found that 5.315% was a reasonable rate of return to expect on respondents' investable assets, only that Brett Van Norman's analysis indicated that historical rate when respondents' inherited stock account was excluded. So the trial court's decision to apply a 4% rate of return was reasonable. It was supported by Mr. Hiley's testimony that he thought it was reasonable. It was supported by Mr. Hiley's testimony that the rates of return being paid on fixed deposits in India were going down to a 4% level. So we believe there's more than sufficient findings.
So he actually did testify to the 4% as a
Hiley
reasonable?
Did. Mr. Hiley did. And in fact, his expert report contains the 4%. So you have a situation where appellant had installed the parties in a luxury apartment that she had never even seen before he leased it, and that cost $11,250 a month. And then he left for the United States, paying no support to respondent until the trial court ordered him to do so 2 years later. As the court pointed out, home ownership was an attribute of the party's standard of living. There was a time where the parties owned two homes, one in Boston, one in Manhattan. And appellant submitted a budget accepted by the trial court that assumed he would be buying a home in Minneapolis. That's what he said in his budget. I'm going to buy a home. Here's my mortgage. Here's what my mortgage is going to be. Trial court accepted it. He made an offer to purchase a home in Linden Hills during the proceeding. But his position at trial was that respondent should move to a distant part of Mumbai and rent an apartment for $3,900 a month. And the trial court found that respondent testified very credibly to her preference to purchase a home and her intent to purchase a home. The trial court said it was not inclined to require respondent to continue to live in either the current apartment or a cheaper apartment in a different area of Mumbai, and found that the purchase of the home would decrease respondent's expenses by $3,500 per month. Now, the price of the home came from appellant's own expert. What would a home like the apartments they had been living in cost? She said $1.2 million. That's their expert. And it made perfect sense to use the stock account she had inherited from her grandfather. It was obviously the best source of funds for the purchase. The stock in that account had never been sold or traded. It had been appreciating for many years. The parties never turned that account into an investment that would create cash flow. So no one benefited from cash flow from that account during the marriage. It was heavily laden with capital gains. India tax law permits capital gain tax to be avoided if the proceeds of appreciated stock are used to purchase a principal residence. That made perfect sense to everyone but appellant and his team. Appellant says that should have been left intact, and the annual appreciation should have been included in respondents' investment income for maintenance purposes. But that appreciation, again, had never been transformed into cash flow available to the parties, and there was no analysis of the substantial taxes that would be incurred incident to the liquidation of that account, absent a reinvestment into a principal residence. And there was some comment by Mr. Bullett that, well, she's getting $2.2 million in cash from Mr. Tenenbaum, she could have used that for the purchase of a house. That's paid over time. That's not one check. She didn't have $2.2 million from Mr. Tenenbaum to buy a home. The only additional thing I would say, the court in Curtis recognized that a dependent spouse does not have a duty to transform all assets into liquid investments. It recognized that a dependent spouse should not, for example, be compelled to sell her principal residence. And that's made clear on page 254 of the Curtis decision. The corollary is that a dependent spouse should not be prohibited from using a portion of her assets to purchase a principal residence where she has none.
And Mr. Dew, on that point, isn't it always, and I understood your argument that it's a bit, the facts are a bit unique from the case law about the speculative nature of a house, because here there'd be no mortgage because we got this fund, it would pay for it. But isn't it inherently for a court making an order today always inherently speculative of what might happen? Wouldn't it be more appropriate to just simply leave things as is, calculate the income, whether it's 4% or the 25%, you know, across the board, and the expense that she had for renting, because she would still be free then in the future on her own? And that would be a less speculative determination of the party's current income and assets?
Well, if the trial court had decided to leave everything alone, then she would have received $3,500 more in spousal maintenance to cover that, because she was paying $11,250 in rent. So the trial court found that the purchase of a home would actually decrease her expenses. Leaving it alone would have increased the amount of spousal maintenance that she needed. Every decision on spousal maintenance requires the trial court to make predictions based on probabilities, not certainties, about what the parties will earn. There's a prediction. What are they going to earn? Where are the parties going to live? That's a prediction. And what's the resulting need going to be? The trial court in this case assessed both credibility and probability and concluded that respondent was likely to follow through on her stated intent. Appellant's assessment of the investable assets respondent would have after the divorce was based on outdated figures for fixed deposits. It didn't take into account the substantial litigation costs that respondent had paid. And again, trial court never found that 5.3% was a reasonable rate of return. The trial court did find that after considering the effects of inflation, respondent's historical rate of return was less than 1%, so applying a 4% rate of return was reasonable.
Mr. Duke, can I ask you something in response to, I saw it in Mr. Boulette's reply brief, this goes to the business valuation issue and goodwill, your client, you basically argued into a paradox because on one hand, pointed out the testimony that your client wasn't the rain, that was not the rainmaker in the business. The appellant was not, and yet it ought not to be considered or to be, he got a sweetheart deal with regard to the stock option purchase, and doesn't that necessarily create a paradox? Why would there be a sweetheart deal for someone who's not so integral to the company that it ought to be considered as part of the goodwill and therefore reduce that pursuant to our case law and understanding of how you calculate valuation?
I understand your question, Your Honor. So the argument is that respondent argued herself into a paradox by asserting that appellant was so important to the company in 2017 that he was given a sweetheart buy-in price, but not important enough to the company as of the valuation date as to warrant a personal goodwill discount. I believe appellant chose the wrong word for his argument. A paradox is defined as a seemingly self-contradictory statement that upon investigation proves to be well-founded or true. And the evidence explains why, in fact, that assertion is true. In 2017, and this comes from Dr. Thorne's testimony, Dr. Thorne wanted a commitment from appellant to continue residing and working in India. And the fact that appellant was married to a woman with impressive connections in Indian society, my client made the arrangement ideal. No doubt Dr. Thorne also hoped that appellant would begin to play more of a rainmaking role in the company. But by the time of the valuation date in 2020, appellant had moved to the U.S. without much notice to Dr. Thorne. He'd left the management of the Indian office largely to Mr. Goyal. His value to the company diminished substantially because of his return to the U.S. and because of the divorce. And the expectation that he would fill Dr. Thorne's shoes never materialized. Dr. Thorne's testimony about appellant's move to the U.S., by the way, is at pages 172 to 174 of the November 8th transcript. So we don't see a contradiction between the trial court's finding that the buy-in price was not persuasive as to value and the trial court's finding that appellant did not demonstrate that any portion of the value of the company was attributable to his personal goodwill.
Your point is he used the right word as defined, you just defined it.
Pardon?
The paradox was the right word from your client's standpoint.
Yes. I think he just meant contradiction.
I said, okay.
On the personal goodwill, I say I only have a minute left. Appellant did not demonstrate by any credible evidence, I mean, there was a lot of self-serving testimony from him, but he didn't demonstrate that any portion of the company's performance fees and profits was attributable to his personal goodwill, and the evidence was to the contrary. The evidence showed that Dr. Thorne was the company's rainmaker, bringing in practically all of the company's new business. Of the 39 new subscriptions made since 2017, and that's listed on Exhibit 169 in the record, Dr. Thorne was responsible for all but two or three of them. The evidence further showed that appellant had returned to the United States again by the valuation date. He was no longer providing the boots on the ground management in India, and that was provided by Mr. Goyal. And it can't escape notice that appellant proposed a bonus for Mr. Goyal of $360,000. That's more than his position on what the whole company was worth. It just makes no sense. Alan Johnson testified that appellant was replaceable as long as his replacement was paid at market wage and the company was saleable without appellant, most probably to a competitor. So when you look at the case law, well, I know my time is up, but there's two issues. Whether the valuation of the business impermissibly capitalizes a spouse's reasonable compensation, or whether the business is dependent on the specialized skills or personal reputation of the spouse in order to generate revenue. Well, Mr. Tenenbaum's personal compensation was not capitalized. That was excluded. And I would suggest that the evidence is pretty strong that the company is not dependent on his specialized skills or personal reputation for the generation of revenue. In fact, this company was profitable for 23 years before appellant became an owner. I know my time is up, so that's what I have.
Very
thank
well.
You.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant, you now have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors, and once again, Michael Boulette for appellant. Counsel makes an important point that I'd like to address at the outset, which is that with the exception of reviewing Mr. Tenenbaum's buy-in as a contract de novo, this is an abuse of discretion case. So let me articulate in a minute and a half the abuse of discretion on each of our three issues. With respect to maintenance, it is an abuse of discretion to calculate a spouse's ongoing income at a level significantly below what that spouse has earned historically. In other words, and applied to this case, it is an abuse of discretion to assume that a spouse will reallocate her investable assets, $6 million of investable assets, to earn far less income at a far lower rate than what she has ever experienced historically. In the same way, it would be an abuse of discretion to assume that a spouse has a need for maintenance because they quit their job. As to the options, it is an abuse of discretion to value an obligation to buy into a company at specific dates as an option. That is simply not what an option is as a matter of law and based on the plain language. Undoubtedly, parties can use the term option freely, but the district court has an obligation, which this court reviews de novo, to look at the contractual language and determine, is this an option as it's being used for valuation purposes? When a party must buy in at a specified price on specific dates, we are no longer dealing with an option as a matter of law.
Do you agree with the respondent that your characterization of that argument has evolved?
I don't, Your Honor. There is, the parties have a multinational structure by virtue of the fact that they invest overseas, and so have chosen to structure that in a way in which they've used the term option loosely, but repeatedly throughout Mr. Tenenbaum's testimony, and we cite this in our reply brief, he has said option and obligation, that there are two sides to this coin which go hand in hand and that can't be missed. In addition, our proposed judgment and decree made exactly this argument. You cannot value as an option something that is also a corresponding obligation. That comes straight out of Black's Law Dictionary. It must be an option, but not an obligation. Finally, with respect to business valuation, it is an abuse of discretion because it misapplies the law to treat goodwill as an all or nothing exercise, personal goodwill. It is not. The court had to exclude from value any portion of business value, intangible business value, that related to Mr. Tenenbaum's future services to that company. If you don't, you capitalize the spouse, something you've already done, in effect, by providing Ms. Deshpande with spousal maintenance. Counsel says in remarks to this court that we simply didn't meet our burden of proof. 2 points. First, there is no burden of proof with respect to value. Value is an issue that gets decided without regard to burden of proof and where both parties have a burden of production. Secondly, Mr. Tenenbaum was the only party that provided evidence on personal goodwill. Both Ms. Deshpande's experts simply said, we didn't perform that exercise. We're not saying there's no personal goodwill. We're simply saying we didn't perform that exercise because we weren't asked to. Similarly, and Judge Sleater and counsel pointed out, I may have gotten a bit too fancy for myself in my verbiage. It's not a paradox, it's just a contradiction. The marriage spent less than $500,000 on Mr. Tenenbaum's buy-in, less than barely 2 years before the valuation date. It belies belief that a business interest that the marriage purchased for $500,000 is now worth $5 million when it has less cash and lower profits than just 2 years before. Finally, in my remaining 50 seconds, Judge Sleater, I want to clarify the record on this 4% rate of return. Confidential Addendum 35, the court finds specifically, without the weighted 25.73% return of the stock account, Ms. Deshpande's remaining assets result in an estimated rate of return of 5.315%. If you look at page 31 of Respondent's brief, you will see that at that rate of return, she has a surplus between $3,000 a month, beyond her $17,000 in needs, and $9,000 a month. In other words, she has between $3,000 and $9,000 more than her $17,000 needs just by taking the more conservative rate the district court found. By contrast, if I can have just one more moment,
yes.
The district court made the finding that Ms. Deshpande's expert testified that the 4% rate of return is commonly used by financial experts in Minnesota for a party who is investing her multi-million dollar stock account in Mumbai. Thank you, Your Honors, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your efforts to condense the record for us and with your arguments today and your briefing. We'll take the matter under advisement, issue an order within 90 days.
Thank you
each have a good day.